Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, conversion laws and religious fundamentalism. Just some of the concerns for the Catholic Church in India today. We'll hear from one Catholic spokeswoman on some of the challenges it faces. Monsignor Anthony Figueredo of the Pontifical Council Cor Unum continues his series of reflections on the Gospel readings for the five Sundays of Lent, and remembering Pope John Paul II's special friendship with Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Christians in India have expressed alarm following the arrest of 14 people for having converted to Christianity. At the end of March, police arrested 12 tribal Indians and two Protestant pastors in the state of Orissa. The converts violated the Orissa Freedom of Religion Act, which ironically bans any conversion without a permit issued by authorities. Critics of the act say Orissa is one of six Indian states that adopted the conversion law under pressure from fundamentalist Hindu groups who accuse Christians of proselytism and conversions for money. To date, neither claim has ever been proven. The Global Council of Indian Christians has condemned the arrests and called for a stop to anti-Christian violence. In recent years, Hindu radicals have carried out attacks against Christians in Orissa. In 2008, 100 Christians were killed and another 55,000 forced to leave their homes. Christian groups have called for full investigations of the involvement of the Indian Army in the massacre against Christians in Orissa. Well, I spoke with Avril Stone of the Council of Catholic Women's National Secretariat in Bangalore. She told me the rise in religious fundamentalism is one of the primary challenges to the church in India.
Being a minority religion in India, we sometimes get to be the target of this. And witnessing our faith, this is becoming increasingly difficult in India because we are not allowed, or we find it difficult to openly witness, and there are problems even in so-called people who want to embrace the Catholic faith or the Christian faith. Conversion has become an issue. They cannot freely and openly do it in most cases. And this is frightening because many people believe in, you know, watching Christians, seeing the way they live and seeing the way they serve the community. They like what we do, but they find it very difficult. Now, we've had a lot of problems in the recent years in Orissa, where the Christians were persecuted against. All the churches were burnt down. Thousands of Christians were uprooted, and they still live in camps, very small camps, small rooms, 20 by 15, in which you would get about 40 to 50 men, women, children living together, not even belonging to the same family. So they have no privacy, they have no proper hygiene services or bathrooms enough to cater for them. They live in appalling conditions. But if they want to go back to their homes, they are forced to convert back to Hinduism.
And why do you say convert back to Hinduism? They were originally Hindu?
They were originally Hindu, some of them, most of them maybe. And over the centuries they've been, you know, perhaps some of their forefathers had joined. Because primarily, I mean, we all come down from some kind of change, isn't it? We're not a Christian country. So they are forced to convert back to Hinduism, and many of them cannot do that because their faith is so strong, and so they choose to live in those conditions. They continue to live in those conditions. And
what is the local church trying to do to help these people?
Yes, the local church, the bishop, has been doing a lot. And there we have some lay representatives. There is one, Mr. John Dayal, who does a lot for this, who's been following this issue and seeing that it even remains in the minds, because we had recently an article, Kandahar, lest we forget, because, you know, things happen when they're sensational, everybody's talking about it, but after a while the next sensation comes along and everybody forgets, and the people who are suffering still remain. And now this has happened in a state that is ruled by the Hindu Nationalist Party, that's the BJP. It is difficult over there for these people to work, for the bishop to work. And, you know, the whole problem stemmed with one of the leaders, the swamis, being murdered, you know. And
they blamed it on the Christians.
They blamed it on the Christians because they said because he was preaching against conversions that the Christians. So finally, when Bishop Chinath and John Dayal have been working about this to help the Christians here, now they have even fostered allegations that they have been responsible for the mother. So, you know, it is, you could do anything if you wanted to, and it is very challenging for them. So the bishops are doing, and the Christian women, even women from our organization, the tribal women, have all, at the time of the problem, they had all got together and, you know, helped the families, helped the people who were scattered. And, you know, they were of great moral support. And otherwise they would, you know, get back to other people they know for other physical support, you know, financial or material. So the women have done, the women, the tribal women are very brave women. They have conviction about their religion. They're very strong. I remember years ago, about 15 years ago, when I first joined the council, the women telling me that when some people came to claim the church lands and they came with guns, you know, they just stood and in front of the land and said, "You shoot us first and take the land." So that is their conviction. So, you know, they are very inspirational.
What sort of dialogue is going on now, though, to bring about reconciliation and understanding between Hindus and Christians?
Well, as far as the people are concerned, there's really no problem, you know. There is harmony. This is mainly politically instigated. People are using religion for political gains, so this is the trouble. It's the problem remains among the politicians, but then they can certain sectors can instigate these problems. So,
do you see a role here for the government to play?
Yeah, but the government is also very cautious because they're also again political. They need the votes, so you can't, you know, side one section against the other. So, not really much, I think, is being done in a strong way. They may be taking care of refugees and problems, but to really establish a dialogue, I think it's only the people themselves who would, like through churches and groups, be doing something small. But perhaps that's not enough to have a national impact.
Other challenges to the church in your country, in India, would be female infanticide and also the question of dowries.
Yes. Well, this doesn't happen among Christians because, you know, it's not so prevalent. This female infanticide is, it does stem in a way from dowry because, you know,
because the men expect a male heir.
Yeah. The son preference is very strong, and all because people believe that, you know, the son will remain in the home and look after them in their old age. And so all the property is given to the son. And now I'm not talking in general. These are specific communities, you see. It doesn't happen everywhere. But surprisingly, it is happening in forward states. You would expect this to happen among ignorant, uneducated people. But it does happen in states like Punjab and Haryana, where people are educated and know this, and they prefer to have sons because they will work in their family property. And so girls at the time of marriage are given some kind of money settlement and don't have any right to property after that. You see, so people don't want to have daughters. And so female infanticide is a big problem. We have like 927 females to 1,000 males. That's something like our demographic. So that that really is a concern. And in places like that, it's openly professed. I've heard people from their report that they have vans that go around in cities saying, rather pay 40 rupees now and get rid of your female child than pay 40,000 rupees later for your dowry. So, you know, that's the way it goes on. And that is very sad. But in the south, this is not a major problem. And among Christians, these, because of our Christian education, these are not things that I encourage. So it's not a problem at all.
Averil Stone is a member of the Council of Catholic Women in Bangalore, India. In his Lenten message for 2011, Pope Benedict invited the faithful to reflect carefully on the symbol of baptism and on the gospel readings over Lent. Sunday, April 10th, marks the fifth Sunday in the Lenten period. The reading about Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead comes from the Gospel of St. John.
The sisters of Lazarus sent word to Jesus, saying, "Master, the one you love is ill." When Jesus heard this, he said, "This illness is not to end in death, but is for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was ill, he remained for 2 days in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. But Mary sat at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise." Martha said, "I know he will rise in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, even if he dies, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I have come to believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one who is coming into the world." He became perturbed and deeply troubled and said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Sir, come and see." And Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not the one who opened the eyes of the blind man have done something so that this man would not have died?" So Jesus, perturbed again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay across it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the dead man's sister, said to him, "Lord, by now there will be a stench. He has been dead for 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you for hearing me. I know that you always hear me. But because of the crowd here, I have said this, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said this, he cried out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, tied hand and foot with burial bands, and his face was wrapped in a cloth. So Jesus said to them, "Untie him and let him go." Now many of the Jews who had come to Mary and seen what he had done began to believe in him.
In his message for Lent 2011, Pope Benedict said, "Faith in the resurrection of the dead and hope in eternal life open our eyes to the ultimate meaning of our existence. God created men and women for resurrection and life," he said, "and this truth gives an authentic and definitive meaning to human history. to the personal and social lives of men and women, to culture, politics, and the economy. Without the light of faith, he said, the entire universe finishes shut within a tomb, devoid of any future, any hope. Well, I asked Monsignor Anthony Figueredo of the Pope's charity office, Cor Unum, what he makes of this gospel and how it should relate to us.
The Pope, in his Lenten message, puts before us this ultimate question, which we all have. He announces to us, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? And the Church in this Lenten period, as the Pope says, wants us to make a journey where we come to recognize that Jesus is the resurrection. You are the Christ. And this gives us, the Pope says, a spirit which overcomes the barrier of death. He's not only talking about physical death at the end of our lives, but he's talking about the little deaths we face every day. You know, we have that expression, this really kills me. It's some event, some suffering, some difficulty, even a person, where we say, this person, this event really kills me. But what does it mean to be a Christian? To be a Christian doesn't mean to adhere to a set of laws, to fulfill the Sunday prescription. These things are good. But ultimately, to be a Christian means to have within us the spirit of the risen Christ, where I no longer live for myself, but I live for the other. And this is our joy. This is our joy. And this transforms, the Pope makes a very interesting point, because he says this spirit living in us transforms culture, transforms politics, transforms economy. So often we believe that we have to change the structures of society in order to make the world better. The Church, through Jesus, believes that we need to begin with the human heart. Otherwise, as the Pope says in very strong language, we remain in our tomb, devoid of any future, of any hope. This is why in the Holy Father's second encyclical, Tracy, Spe Salvi, Saved by Hope, the Pope talks about this encounter with Jesus not simply as informative, as information. So often we reduce Christianity to the books. No, it's also performative, which means it changes my life, and this changes society.
Why, when he heard about Lazarus's illness, did Jesus purposely decide to stay where he was, delaying his trip to Lazarus's home? Yeah. I mean, a friend, it seems, wouldn't do that.
First of all, I think we have to look at our reading of Ezekiel, the first reading of Sunday, where we have this vision of a vast field of dry bones, and there is the hopelessness of the people, where they cry out, our hope has vanished, we are lost. And God makes a promise in front of this hopelessness, I will open your graves and have you rise from them. And Jesus comes to fulfill this promise. But what he wants the people to understand is that we have to pass through the cross, we have to pass through the suffering, we have to pass through death in order to experience the power of God. Because, you know, they said, if you were here, this would not have happened to our brother. He would not have died. But it's exactly in the tragedy, it's exactly in the suffering, it's exactly in those moments where we are powerless, as St. Paul says, that we experience the power of God, for it is when I am weak that Christ is strong. This is why sometimes in our life, Tracy, God in fact allows us to be reduced to hopelessness in order that we learn not to lean on our own strength, but we learn to lean on the power of God. And when we've experienced, had this personal encounter with Jesus, who transforms what seems untransformable, then we will never want to leave him. And I think this is why he says, he allows Lazarus to remain in his tomb, to go to the tomb, to remain there for 4 days, stinking, until he comes to raise him from his wretchedness.
At the same time, when Jesus finally does get in there and sees Lazarus and talks with Lazarus' family, he is perturbed and he weeps. So obviously he's feeling sorry, if not bad, for coming late. I mean, help me out with this a little bit. Why is Jesus perturbed? Why does he cry?
I think it shows that Jesus was human. He was a great friend of this family. So truly he touched the suffering of these sisters and the loss of Lazarus. And this can give us hope that Jesus touches the depths of every kind of suffering we go through in life. So it is true that Jesus himself experiences this loss. But in a real sense, I think that this suffering of Jesus, in fact, moves him even more to raise Lazarus from the dead. I think this is how God reacts for us. You know, he looks at the world, and, you know, theologically speaking, I would say that God in himself can't suffer because he's God. But he certainly is moved by the events in the world. He is certainly moved not to leave us in these situations of death, of tragedy. And he actually wants these events, we can say, actually moves the heart of God to act with power in our own lives in order to bring good from even the greatest of tragedies. I really believe this, Tracy, in my own life. And this is linked very much as well with prayer. I'm thinking of those people in the earthquake, you know, in Japan. They're buried under the rubble and all hope has been lost. But then suddenly there's a cry which comes out from beneath the rubble, which gives a sign of life. And God hears our cry from the rubble of our lives. This comes through prayer. And he doesn't leave us beneath the rubble. He comes to pull us out of our tombs, of our graves, and to give us hope and new life. This is why that, you know, Lazarus had to die again. He was raised from his tomb, but he had to die again. So what Jesus has ultimately come to give us is not simply a resurrection from our physical death, this offer, but also a resurrection of the heart today to say, I love you, I care for you, and I am with you so much that I wish you not to die, but to live. Live in me, live in my love. This is the offer that Jesus makes to us this Lent.
When a loved one is struck by illness or even death, we turn to God, often asking for a miracle, that this person be healed or even like Lazarus, raised from the dead. If God can do all things, is it unrealistic for us to ask for miracles?
God can work miracles. The one who created the heavens and earth, the one who opened the Red Sea, the one who raised Lazarus from the dead, the right arm of God has not dried up, and God can perform every kind of miracle. Physical miracles, we know, can happen, absolutely. But the real miracle that God wants to give us is the moral miracle. Because, you know, if you have a physical miracle and God saves you from a cancer, this is fantastic. But eventually we will die again. But the miracle of the heart testifies to my heart that God loves me, that God is with me. He gives me a spirit that overcomes that barrier of death that the Pope speaks of in his Lenten message. And this spirit living in my heart, this risen spirit that is stronger than death, enables me to pass through every kind of sickness, every kind of suffering, every kind of difficulty. This is why we read in that wonderful psalm of the Good Shepherd, of the Lord is my shepherd, remember. Even if I go through a dark valley, you are there with me. This is what I mean by the moral miracle, the miracle of the heart, to know to believe that Jesus is risen from the dead? This is exactly the question that is put to us as we now approach Holy Week. Yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ. And this conviction living within my heart enables me to go forward despite the struggles in my life.
And a very warm thanks there to Monsignor Anthony Figueredo, an official with the Pontifical Council Cor Unum. Monsignor Anthony was a friend of Mother Teresa of Calcutta's and worked for a time with Pope John Paul II here in the Vatican. As we recall the late Pope ahead of his beatification May 1st, I asked Monsignor Anthony to remember the close relationship between the two blessed.
Both Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa are icons of our age. Why? Because we look at John Paul II and towards the end of his life, his body was so weak. I mean, he was stooped, he was fragile, he was trembling. He held onto that cross as his support. And then we had Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who in her old age, she too had grown from all her work and all her suffering and all her goodness. She had grown old and tired. And the very last time that Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa met was in St. Peter's Basilica. And it was at the end of a Mass, and I was quite close in that area where Mother Teresa was sitting in her wheelchair. And when Pope John Paul II came down from the sanctuary, leaning on his cross, his pastoral staff, he made a beeline for Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And as soon as Mother saw this great Pope coming towards her, she jumped from her wheelchair, and they went to embrace each other. And that really struck me as the greatest of all messages for our time. It was almost the greatest pulpit that one can preach from, because what was it saying to the world? That God's power is made perfect in weakness. My grace is sufficient. Because what were they giving to each other? The joy of a life spent for the last ones. Here they were, where most of us would be, you know, in our weakness, we would not want to appear in the public eye. We would be closed in our rooms and say, I simply want to be hidden from the world. But here these two, old, fragile, wanted to be publicly seen as transmitting joy in weakness. It reminded me of the gospel story where the Blessed Virgin Mary goes to her cousin Elizabeth in her old age, and she runs across the hill country to bring a good news to Elizabeth. What was the good news? That you too will bear a child. The same announcement that the angel gave me, that I will bear Jesus, is the announcement that is given to you. You will bear a child. You will bear new life. God's life is stronger than any suffering, any death, any disappointment we can experience. This is what I remember of John Paul II and Teresa of Calcutta. Even in their old age, we can bear fruit and give fruit.
I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.